I did mention how the course overall is structured. So in this overall course, I wanted to take the first 2 weeks to be a bit more interactive and teach some skills that are useful outside of computational physics as well. And afterward, we're starting with things that are a bit more theoretical, for example, partial differential equations, optimization problems, relativistic hydrodynamics, and so on. But these first 2 weeks will be a bit more hands-on, and correspondingly, the lectures are not really lectures, they're more or less lab sessions, and it was quite unstructured in the beginning last time, and it might be the same this time. What we used last time to program in Julia was a JupyterHub notebook that, of course, can also be used for Python and for R, other languages. And it's a notebook, like in Mathematica, you write something from top to bottom, and I want to compare that to something that you write on a blackboard. If you have an interactive discussion, or if you want to just try something out, this is a very good way of exploring things. But if you want to disseminate some knowledge, if you did something, want to show it to the others, to the community, then a screenshot of a blackboard or a recorded lecture is not the right way of doing things, right? A blackboard is good to learn what the person did who wrote it there. But if you want to based on something and want to publish a proof, for example, then you would write it up in a paper and publish it in a specific format. You would spend a bit of time making it look nice. And the corresponding thing exists also in software engineering. There are these JupyterHub notebooks, which are just for sketching things out. But at some point, you want to package it up nicely. And that is then called the Julia package that one creates. And papers get uploaded to the archive. And Julia packages, most software these days that is open source, gets uploaded to GitHub. And we are going to discuss that next week. Dustin will teach that. And what I want to teach today is how to create a Julia package. Now, in this course, you're probably not going to do any big projects that last for 3 months or something. So you might not actually need to create a Julia package. But I still want to push you in this direction. I want to show you how it's done professionally. And maybe at a later time, if you actually have your own Julia packages, work on bigger projects, then you know how to do that. And that might be a useful skill. So programming in JupyterHub is one thing. If you create a Julia package, unfortunately, that is not possible with JupyterHub, but there are other software that helps you with that. So I'm here on the Julia homepage, and if you scroll down almost to the bottom, there's a section editors and IDEs, integrated development environments, and the Jupyter is the part we used last time, and the other three in the top row, Juno, VS Code, and JetBrains, are professional development environments that people would also use in software engineering in a company. Most of these are based on JavaScript or Java or something similar, but they all have plugins that make it support Julia. And in such an IDE, you get nice support. If you write code, it's automatically syntax highlighted, it indents the code. There are maybe mechanisms to rename a variable everywhere that it's used and you don't make any mistakes or other things like that. There are tests you can run the code. If there's a debugger, if there's an error message, it automatically jumps to the right file, to the right line number, et cetera, and so on. So of these three, I've looked at Juno and VS Code, and the JetBrains is probably similar. And I don't think there's a big difference between these. I might have a slight preference for VS Code of these. And the four at the bottom are essentially just editors, text editors that you could also use to, say, edit LaTeX code, unless you're using Overleaf for such a public system. Vi, Vim, and Emacs are old school from Unix. Each of these are probably more than 40 years old. And there's a big fight going on. I myself, I'm an Emacs fan, but I shouldn't mention that. There are probably Vi fans here in the audience. And Sublime Text and Notepad are probably more from the Mac and Windows community. They essentially allow you to edit files. And if you want to create a Julia package, you're going to have to edit some files, also files containing metadata, not just Julia code. For example, there are files containing a README, just a description of a project, files that are describing on what other package the thing depends on and so forth. So in the beginning, I want you to choose one of these methods, and then, or maybe that's not such a good idea, I'm going to show you how to use Emacs, and if you use SSH to log into Symmetry, then you can use Emacs or Vi there as well. So let's do that. Let's get started. But if you're into Julia programming, I recommend that you take one of the top three, Junior, VS Code, or JetBrains, check it out, and install it on your laptop. That gives you a bit more boost. And these, it's not just for Julia, right? They support many other languages, including Python, JavaScript, and so on and so forth. So let me open a terminal here, new terminal. Going to log into Symmetry. And what I want to do is create a Julia package, and that does not really work with Jupyter. You have to use the command line. So I'm going to go to a particular directory and type a command there. And if you have your laptop open, you can follow me along. Do you all know how to use a terminal to log into Symmetry? It depends if you use Mac or Ubuntu, it should be straightforward. If you use Windows, it might be a problem. It's not here. Okay, so this is an interactive lab session today, at least the first half. So feel free to talk, feel free to talk to your neighbor, and feel free to just speak up and ask questions and complain if I go too fast. So I'm going to type module load Julia. And I'm going to start the Julia interpreter. And ignore the warning messages. You probably don't get these warning messages. And next, I'm going to generate a new package. And for that, I type the closing square bracket, make everything blue, and then type generate and the name of the package. And the Julia package that I want to live code with you today is something. I mean, you need to come up with something, right? I thought about maybe implementing complex numbers or so, but that's a bit boring because complex numbers are only there. So I'm going to implement something with particles, and whatever particles have a position and the mass. And I'm going to implement a function where you can merge two particles, and it's supposed to conserve mass and center of mass. Something simple. So I'm calling that module particles, and it's customary in Julia to use uppercase letter for module names, for package names. Although that's not really necessary, you can do anything you want. And then something happens, and after a few seconds it's done, and it created a package particles. I'm going to switch forth and back between this window and another window, and because I don't like switching forth and back, I'm just going to open a second window and log in again. SSH symmetry. And now a new directory particles was created. That was what the package generate did. Let's go there. And here I'm going to type Emacs. And then with Control X, Control F, I can look at the directory. And this is the directory that contains, that was generated. This directory contains the Julia package particles. Okay. This was a bit technical at the beginning. Who of you is still following me? You're welcome to type or just
the directory.
Pardon?
Can you say again in Emacs how to see the directory?
It's Control X, Control F. And if you had something else installed, for example, Visual Studio Code, then this would be just the natural window that shows up and everything would be much easier. Then you don't need these arcane commands.
Sorry, what did you do after logging into Symmetry? I just logged in.
Oh, okay. I went into the directory where the package was generated. And since the package is called particles, there's a subdirectory particles. I went in there, and there I ran a command called Emacs. Okay, let me go out and do it again.
The module load Julia part. On the right hand screen, if you look up, there's module load Julia.
Oh, yeah, but that's on the right hand side. And then I start Julia. And the only thing I'm doing here is this generate particles. So I type the closing square bracket to switch the things to blue and generate particles. And that's it. Yes?
You like for your students like SSH?
Oh, yes. Yes, you do. Apologies. I was not thinking of that. Do you want to install Visual Studio Code or something on your laptop? That would quickly help you out.
I mean, I already have Julia.
Okay, very good. Yeah, then you don't need to do that. Then you should be able to start Julia. And without logging into Symmetry, you can just follow the instructions here from starting Julia and generate particles. Did you send me email earlier about taking the class?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Yes. So if you have Julia on your laptop, it's just fine. Yes. So what you do when the line is here, it shows a different prompt. You press the closing square bracket, and then the prompt switches from green to dark blue into package manager mode. I described that on Monday as well. And then you can type generate particles. If you're not in package manager mode, then you get an error if you type generate particles. For example, usually the prompt looks like this, light green, difficult to see on the screen. And with a closing square bracket, it turns into this one. Okay. And then you created a package called particles. And now I'm using an editor to look at the package and to look at the files that are generated. Okay. If you're not familiar with the Unix command line or with starting an editor, that might take a few minutes to get used to that. I'd be happy to help out. Dustin, do you want to walk between the aisles and see whether anybody is stuck? Okay. I'll wait another minute, and then I'll go on. Then we're going to look at the empty package that was generated, and we're going to fill in the details and add a bit of Julia code there.
So it's okay.
And generally what we're doing is like when you create a new LaTeX document, when you write a paper, then you have to probably create a directory, create a file there, write the document style, document class, begin, end document, and so on. Lots of stuff that you have to do before you can actually type anything. Okay, so let's look at the files that were created here. One file that was created is project.toml. Toml is just a suffix that means that it's a configuration file that contains certain definitions. If you open it and look at the file, then it says the name of the project is particles. The ID is this automatically generated ID. It's unique on the planet. So each generated package has its own ID, even if the names happen to be the same. And then authors, it figured out my name and my email address and version number. Apparently Julia thinks version 010 is a good version to start from. Why not? And then there's a directory source. And if you look in the source directory, there's a file particles.jl. And this is where the main Julia code goes. And if you open that file, then we see it's a module particles. The module ends here where the end module statement is. And in between, it defines one function greet, which just says hello world. And of course, that's just a dummy thing. We're going to delete that and do something real soon.
Yes, it's the same.
Okay, are you all there? Are you in your editor and can you type something?
So some people say that Emacs stands for...
I'm not getting much feedback from you. So please speak up and complain if you're slow. The lecture is for you. Okay, so we want to talk about particles. And particles, they have a position and they have a mass. So let's define a data type that defines a single particle and just holds a position on the mass. It's going to be similar to what we did yesterday when we define a struct. So just going to type struct particles. There's no Julia mode here. Oh, there's a position. Let's call it posX, which is a float 64. There's a position Y, which is a float 64. And there's a mass, which is a float 64, and this is a particle. And then here in the Julia interpreter, I'm going to exit it by pressing Ctrl D and going into the particles directory as well. I'm restarting Julia, and then I'm going to type using particles.
Particles or D?
Project equals at dot or something.
This is filling me with confidence.
Yes, okay. Apologies. So what we're now going to do, we're going to use the Julia interpreter to load that module and play with the module that we wrote. So I'm in this directory, source Julia particles, that was the directory that created, and I'm starting Julia, and I'm giving its option dash dash project equals add dot. And yeah, it's a bit arcane. It's like running LaTeX from the command line or so something. So if you do that, then we are in here.
Sorry, how do we get out of package mode again?
If you want to quit Julia, you press Ctrl D, and out of package mode is escape. Okay, I made a mistake in my Julia code. I had the module called particles and the data type called particles. It's a bad idea. They need to have different names. So we named the data type particle. That's what I intended anyway, because it describes only a single particle. And then in Julia, I can say using particles. And then it precompiles it, and then I can use it. And if I try to create a particle, then it does not work yet. For example, 1, 1, whatever position, the origin and mass 1. This does not yet work because the module by default hides all the contents. If you want to make something visible outside a module, you need to explicitly export it. That means when you write a larger program, you control which are just internal functions that you don't want to show to anybody else, and which are the things that people are supposed to use from the outside. So let's go here, and let's export a structure, say export particle. And then it becomes visible. And let's see whether this now works. Yes, very good, very good. There's a particular problem in Julia. I didn't design it, that once you imported a module, if you import it again, it doesn't actually re-import it. Because it already imported it, it doesn't do that. If you want to make that work, then one way to do that is to quit your Julia interpreter and restart it again. Yeah, that. And if you say using particles now, then we can create a particle P equals a particle that sits at the origin.
Doesn't the revise help you?
Revise helps, yes. I didn't want to mention revise because installing revise is a bit complicated because you have to modify a startup file. I think that's too complicated for a tutorial, but otherwise I am using revise. I just haven't installed it for this version of Julia, and I don't want to do that now because it would confuse people. Yes?
Did you have to be in a particular directory in order to load the module?
Yes, you have to be in the directory where the Julia package is. And for me, that is the directory. Let me scroll up. Source JL particles. I put all my Julia code into source JL. So this is where the particles things was created. And you have to be in there. And you have to start the Julia interpreter with this particular magic incantation. /test project equals add dot. Now, if you had installed one of these IDEs, for example, VS Code or Atom or something, then none of these low-level shenanigans would be necessary. Once you install it, you can just write your code, create a package, and everything works out of the box. This is because I'm using this more low-level Unix-y kind of work, where I'm using Emacs that gives you the old-style Unix feeling. Yes?
So kernel, if I type using particles, it keeps telling me that like I need to run package.add particles.
That means you started Julia without this option /test project equals add dot.
And when you do that, do you have to be in the same directory?
You have to be in the particles directory, yes.
And that means something like look in the current directory for files? Or
yes, I think that's what the add dot means. It might also work if you write project equals add and then some other directory name. I don't know.
Then is this how you would do like your like edit test check?
This is how do my edit test and so on for modules.
Okay.
I mean, Jupyter Hub is the other thing for small ones, but if I work in a big thing, I just do that. It's a bit arcane, but you get used to it pretty quickly, and then it's not that bad. But if you need to teach it to someone else, then this is a hurdle that they have to get across. Okay, so this was the particle. Now let's add a function to our module that combines two particles and conserves the center of mass. and conserves mass. Maybe you want to help me write that function? Function merge, p is a particle, q is a particle. End of the function, and then we create a new particle. And what's the position, the x position of the new particle? Nobody's thinking along. I have to do all the math here. Okay. The x position of the merged particle is
42.
p dot mass times p dot pos x plus q dot mass times q dot pos x divided by or something similar. I don't know. We'll write a test case later on. Don't worry if it doesn't work. So this is a function. And of course, we want to export that function as well. Export merge. And then let me restart the kernel and use the new function. We're going to make that a bit more complicated very soon. And then we have a particle p and a particle q. And then we can merge p and q. No! What? Ah! The function merge is, oh, okay, good. Going to have to rename it because there is already a merge function. Let's call it pmerge. P, Q, and I merge the particles. Pmerge, because I'm being a bit slow today. And then you get a merged particle, and that might or might not be correct. Okay, you're probably still busy implementing the merge function. Is there something you don't like about the merge function? So what I don't like about that merge function here is that it is a bit long to write all these things. And this p dot mass plus q dot mass, the masses of the particles p and q, that expression appears 3 times. And I don't really like that. So I'm going to simplify the function a bit. I'm introducing a new variable m, which is just the sum of all the masses. Then if I was able to type, and then the new particle. And the function looks a bit simpler. Yes?
You don't have to write return or anything? It's
just no, you don't.
The last line of the function.
In Julia, yeah, it's a functional language. So the last expression calculated in a function is the return value. That's similar to what you would... A Mathematica has a module construct, which is the same thing. I mean, the Mathematica module is kind of like a Julia function in a certain way or something. That the Mathematica module allows you to write several statements after each other and let the last statement in a Mathematica module is the return value. I don't know why they called it a module in Mathematica. But still, that this merge function is a bit complicated, right? There are these letters p and q, and it's easy to make a mistake. And there's pos x and pos y, the two positions. It's easy to mix up x and y. And does it really conserve mass? And does it really conserve the center of mass? It's not quite clear. If you write a paper and put a proof into a paper, then you read the paper very carefully, and then the referees read the paper, and then you kind of think it's okay. But if you write a package in Julia, there are better ways to ensuring that the code is correct. Namely, you can create a test case. And in a test case, you have a certain sample input that you write, certain sample code, and then you can check that the output is correct. If someone else wants to use your package, they can look at the test cases, and that makes them more confident that the code is actually correct. Also, if you change your code later on, you can easily rerun the same test cases. And it's better to actually write the test cases in such a way that they can be rerun every time you make a change. That's better than just calling the function once and saying, yeah, it works now, and then discarding the test case. When every time you write something complicated code, you're going to test it. But it's a good idea to keep the test cases around. So, were you all able to call the pmerge function and get some merged particles? Hmm. Okay, I'm going to walk through the aisles again, because what we're going to do next is going to explain Julia's mechanism for creating a test case for a package. And I want you able, you all be at the same spot here. Okay, I think you're all there. So now I want to show you how to create a test case for the code. So if you remember, this was the structure of the package that is created, and we need to create a new directory there called test. You can either create it in Emacs, or you can use the mkdir command on the command line. And in this test, we are going to create a file runtests.jl. And there we write using particles. And then we check something. Sorry, I'm not used to using Emacs on the command line. So, okay. Merge particle, let's call it S, let's call it R. So let's go back. If you want to create test cases for a Julia package, you have to go to the package directory. That's where the project.toml and the source directory is. And you have to create a new directory called test there. And one way to do that is, for example, if you're on the command line, I left Julia here. I have these files. It's to type mkdir test. That would create a new directory test. I'm getting an error message here because the directory already exists. For you, it will create the directory. And in this directory, I'm creating a new file called runtests.jl. This is the file that we have here. And yeah, you see the file name here at the bottom. And in this test case, I type basically what I used to type up here in the Julia shell, just these commands using particles, p equals, q equals, and then r equals the pmerge. Going to add another command at show R. And then I'm going to run the test command in package manager mode, and the test command tests the package. So it runs all the commands in the run test file. It's a bit slow to start up. What's happening here? Hello? And what the add show command outputs something to the screen. If I evaluate an expression in Julia on the Julia command line, then it always shows the result. But in a test case, I would have to use add show to actually show the output. And this is, of course, not yet a comfortable way to run a test case, because if it just prints something to the screen, that's not really useful. I wanted to actually check that the result is correct, and then I'll put yay or nay, depending on whether it works or not. I'm going to add that next. Yes.
I have a question. It's like, why when you are in the test directory, it will be in the particles package when you press the
right.
When you press this auto.
Why does it say particles?
Yeah.
That's because I use the --- project equals add dot, and that means Julia knows it should be part of the project in dot in the current directory. And the current project is called particles. And it probably takes the name particles from the project.toml file. There it says name equals particles. Okay, and here you get the output r equals. Okay. I want to move on and create a real test case. So what I'm going to do to the top of the file, I'm going to say using test. Test is the Julia module that allows it to test Julia code. And that gives a command add test. And then I can write test equals particle, what is it? Two-thirds, three. And then if I write test, should get an error message. Yes, because package test is not found. My Julia package particles now uses the test package, and I need to describe that it actually depends on the package. So I need to say add test. That tells everybody who wants to use my package that my package depends on the test package. I wish that was a bit faster. And if I run test again, then it runs the code, and it runs the test case here, and it says particles tests passed. And if I have a test here that is wrong, for example, if you change the last number to 4, then it would not pass. Then you get some output in red, and it says there's a test that failed. OK, so when it comes to testing code, there are a few approaches. One approach is what we did, where we just use the code for one particular example and check whether the result is what one expects. And that, of course, is an easy test case to write, but it's not necessarily the most stringent test, because here we know we can add these two particles and the result is correct. How do we know the result is correct? Well, we did the calculation in our head. That's not really useful. I would not trust myself. There is a more stringent way of testing things, and these are tests called property tests. So I said earlier, the merge function that we write, it's supposed to conserve mass and conserve the center of mass. So a better way would be to create two random particles and to merge them and then calculate the center of mass and the total mass and compare them and see whether it's correct or not. And then instead of doing that for two random particles, we create 100 random particle pairs and run the test case 100 times. And then we see whether it's correct or not. That catches surprisingly many errors. It's, of course, not as stringent as a mathematical proof that it's correct. And unfortunately, the code proving technology isn't there yet that this would be possible. But it catches surprisingly many errors. And that also saves you the effort of manually doing the calculation once, because you just test the properties. And you don't actually have to calculate that these merged particles sit at 2/3 or wherever they're sitting. So let's do that. Test. So hash adds a comment. Property tests for 100 random particle pairs. So I'm going to live code that now, and then we'll see whether it works or where it doesn't work. For n in 1:100 or something. This is the loop in Fortran. I didn't show you how to do a loop yesterday, but this is how you do with a for statement here.
Did you say Fortran?
Yeah. Fortran?
You said Fortran.
A loop
in Fortran.
Good. This is not how you do loops in Fortran. In Fortran, loops start with a do statement. But yes, I also know Fortran. Okay. So let's create one particle. Let's call it P1 equals particle.
That's close. We nearly learned some Fortran.
Oh, now we need a random number. How does it work? Is it just rand or something? Yes. Rand. So three random numbers gives you a random particle. And then P2 gives you another particle, and then whatever, call it P3, 1, P2, and then calculate center of mass, and then the center of mass. Oh, I'm going to define a function for that, right? Center of mass. And I'm going to put that function, because I need it, just into my module as well. Why not? Does that make sense? Yeah, why not? I'm going to just write a center, because it's supposed to conserve center of mass. I'm going to need a function that conserves this, that calculates the center of mass of two particles. So I'm just going to, oh, is that too trivial? No, that's probably too, I don't want to make it trivial. No, I think it's actually too trivial. Oh man, oof. Yeah, okay, my test, it's not a really good test, because what I'm testing here is too trivial. My test case is just going to repeat the code that I already have in the merge function. Sorry about that. Usually it's something more trivial. For example, if you have complex numbers, you can of course put some test cases there, but you know the multiplication for complex numbers is associative. And that's a pretty non-trivial test, right? Because complex number multiplication is a bit of a complex thing if you break it into real and imaginary part, but that would be a good test case. Or each complex number, complex numbers form a field, but there's a multiplicative inverse. So if you take A times A inverse, you get 1, and these are test cases you could write if you have some algebraic properties. For here, it's a bit boring. I'm going to do it anyway, but live coding. Test, there is a point to this, and there's something else that's coming later in the lecture. Okay, so it's P1.mass times P1.expers plus P2.mass times P2.expers equals P3.mass times P3.expers. That is the x position of the x coordinate of the center of mass, the y coordinate of the center of mass, test center of mass, test total mass. That looks good, right? Very good. I'm going to wait a bit, because maybe you want to run that as well. And then I'll let you run that. And then we can discuss how we actually fix the code, because I expect the code to break. I really hope that it actually breaks. Okay, I'm going to run the test case, and I fully expect it to break. Yes, exactly. So I was running the test cases. I assume you ran the test cases yourself as well by now. And you got an error message here, and that says that the expression, the first one, calculating the x coordinate of the center of mass, is not the same. The evaluated value is 4.488 something, and the one day I got here is 0.45. What? Oof.
Because you got a typo.
Yes, I got a typo somewhere, right?
P1.
Oh, there's an, yeah. See? Thank you. Oh, okay. I still expect to have an error in there. Yes, that's much more like it. That's the one I wanted, right? So the expected value is 0.34 and the real value is 0.34. Of course, I mean, I'm using double precision numbers here. They have about 15 digits of accuracy, but that's all they have. And if you look at the very last digits, this ends in 99544 and this ends in 995. So the difference is 10 to the minus 17 or something. It's really, really small, but they're not actually the same. And that, of course, is a problem that you always encounter when you have floating point numbers and do some calculations. The real numbers, there are uncountably infinitely many of them, as is known. But in a computer, they're usually represented as double position numbers. There are 2 to the 64 of these, which is a finite subset of the rational numbers that can be represented. And there is no way to represent real numbers in any better way in a computer, because every algorithm that calculates something is finite. So you can, algorithms can be arbitrarily large. So all the numbers that are accessible to algorithms, there can be only countably many. There are things like computable real numbers, and you can make good approximations of constants like pi or e or log of 2 or something, but almost all real numbers have no names, and they are completely unreachable for algorithms that actually want to construct something. And it is a fundamental problem, and that means the only way out, if you actually want to do calculations and want to do something with real numbers, is that you choose a certain accuracy, an epsilon, and then you compare up to this accuracy epsilon. So it's fundamentally impossible to compare two real numbers for equality. So this is the traditional way out, would be that you say, well, we accept this test if the difference is, say, less than 10 to the minus 12. We have 15 digits of accuracy. We say there's a bit of floating point round off. Floating point round off will be on the order of 10 to the minus 15. So if we accept 10 to the minus 12, everything is fine. But in Julia, there is a different way in which we can address this problem, because we don't actually need to use real numbers here. Our test case, we don't have any irrational functions here. We can also use rational numbers. And rational numbers, of course, are correct. So Julia supports rational numbers, same as Mathematica. And if you want to do these calculations with rational numbers, it would also be fine. Now, in many other languages, you would have to implement your code twice, once for floating point numbers and once for rational numbers. And then you take the rational number code and you test it and you find it's good. But then what about the code for real numbers? That is not really useful. So what you want to do is you write the code once, and you want to be able to use the same code for real numbers and for rational numbers. And this is the parametric types that I introduced last time. And then you test it for rational numbers, and then you know the code is correct. And later on, you use it with a different representation. And that also allows you to use the code with 64-bit precision. Maybe you want to use it with 32-bit numbers at some point. That runs faster. Maybe you want to use big float at some point if you need 100 digits of precision for some calculation, and so on. So in the code that I wrote earlier, I use the old school mechanism where you simply declare, where you choose a particular type and say it's float 64. And for most cases, that's good enough. But here I want to be a bit more clever. I want to show off what we can do in Julia and want to say particles. I want to write a generic particle type that works with any kind of representation of real or rational numbers. So I write particle of type T. I'm modifying the code now. T, what's happening? The screen is frozen. And I say that pos x, pos y, and mass now have this type T. And when I use the particle struct, I can choose whether it's float 64 or rational numbers or float 32 or anything else. I'm also going to have to update the merge function. So this is particle T, particles T. There's this where T I have to add, and that's all the changes I have to do. And this is now something that works again in Jupyter Hub, of course. And in run tests, okay, now, of course, when I create the particle, I want to create a particle. I want to create a random rational number, not a random real number. Let me quickly figure out how to do that. I'm looking at the documentation for RAND. Oh, there's a lot of stuff here. I think it's something like rand float 64 gives the random floating point number, rand float 32 gives a random single position, and then I think rational number is rational integer, no, big int it's called in this language. Yeah, that's not defined. Random numbers don't work for integers. Okay, I'm going to take a wait out. I'm going to take a random integer between 0 and 100 and divide that by 100, and then I have a kind of a random rational number. Yes?
Last time we talked about like saying t was some sort of number, like why don't we do that here? So like could we have any input?
Ah, yes. In principle, we could do that.
Yeah.
But it turns out this is mostly useful when you, for functions. Actually, I should do it here for function number or something. But for structs that hold data, it's typically not useful to put a constraint onto it because depending on what function you use that, it might even make sense to put strings into a particle at some point.
Okay.
I mean, they're weird things. This is just a kind of an experience, but we could also do it for the particle. Okay, let me define a function here. Rand rational equals rand minus 100 to 100. Does this give me an integer? Yes, this is the syntax. And the double division gives rational numbers? Yes. Yes, it does. Good. So I define a random rational number here. And then let's see whether that works now. Okay. I'm going to let you type it, and I'm going to let you run it, and then I'm going to run it myself. That means there might be bugs in there as well. Did you find a bug already?
Does that give like negative passes and stuff?
Oh, it would. It totally would. Thank you. Good catch. Yeah, let's do it like that. Actually, 100 is kind of a small number, right? We can use a million here, so. Actually, the code should work fine from negative masses, right? Because we're not doing any time evolution or something. It's just that the mass must not be zero. Yeah, no, no. With negative masses, you could have two equal but opposite masses, but with zero at the end. Yeah, no. Don't want negative masses. Okay, I'm really curious whether my code works. I'm just going to run it. Float, float, int. What is the problem? Okay. What I did here in the beginning of the test case, I used three integers to find a particle. But the test up here, I wanted to use rational numbers. So I'm going to have to use rational numbers here as well. It's inconvenient. We could fix that by writing a constructor for the particle class that converts everything to the common type. I'm not going to do that because that's something that you use for software engineering to make the package easier to use. It wouldn't actually bring the points across that I want to make here. Yes.
But you say it's really cumbersome. Why don't we just choose a precision and check the approximation?
Because in this case, that would work. But whenever you choose a precision, you have to really make sure that the precision works. What if you have one particle that has a mass of 1 and another particle that has a mass of 10 to the minus 12? And then what precision can you use to make it work? Maybe the code doesn't actually work. So in a simple case like here, where we just do 3 or 4 arithmetic operations after the other, then you have kind of a feeling what kind of precision you get for floating point numbers. But in real world code, it's really difficult to ensure a particular precision. So this trick with rational numbers, I'm quite fond of it, but this is more of a mathematical thinking, because if something is true for rational numbers, it's true, right? It's false or true. There is no floating point Rondorf. But if I was using a real world code, right, if you solve the Einstein equations, or if you have a 100 by 100 matrix and want to make a statement about the determinant or something, then it's always necessary to do what you exactly said. You compare the two numbers, you allow for a certain epsilon, and you might also do things like, you run 100 test cases and you say, if one or two fail, it's probably fine. It's just the precision is a bit less than expected here. But in most of the cases, it still holds. And of course, that's when you begin to have a feeling of unease, because you expect the code to be correct and you don't quite know why it fails. Was it really a special case where it failed or not? And you have to do quite a bit of thinking to justify to yourself that these are cases where the precision doesn't hold. But you're right, most people would just do the precision thing. And of course, if you're worried about that 15 digits are not enough, right? If you have a particle with mass 1 and another mass with 10 to the minus 12, you can just choose a higher precision. You can just do all the calculations with 100 digits of precision, and then you say, yeah, in the end, it must be correct to 90 digits or so, and then it's still correct. But if you want to do that, then instead of rational numbers, you probably want to use big floated numbers. That you can also do that. Okay. So to recap what we did today, I showed you how to write a Julia package. That is an excursion a bit deeper into software engineering, into software development for the actual math that we're doing during this class. Most of this will not be necessary, but I want to show it anyway because it's a good thing to know that it exists and how to do that, how to write test cases and how to present something. If you are interested in computational physics, if you are doing your PhD thesis or postdoc, developing a package that you make available to others, then it would be a good idea to follow these kind of steps. They have a bit of a documentation, they have examples, they have test cases, and they have a proper Julia module that other people can use. Well, not Julia, right? Similar mechanisms exist for other languages. And that makes the code easier to use. It's the same difference as between taking a screenshot, taking a picture of a blackboard, and writing a paper, putting the additional effort in. Obviously, writing a paper is much more effort, but obviously, if you want to make an impact in the community, you have to do the effort of writing a paper. You can't just say, this is a lecture I gave, look at the video recording or similar. And I also showed how Julia modules work, and I gave another motivation why you want to do type generic programming, that is curly brace T, because it allows you to change exactly how the particles are represented. You can use floating point numbers, you could use single precision for speed, you could use these big float numbers, which gives you 80 decimal digits for accuracy if needed, and it's the same code that you write, you just use it in multiple different ways. So if the code is correct once, the other types are probably correct as well. And you can even do crazy things like rational numbers, which give you exact results, same as you'd get in mathematics. Okay. Do you have questions? Okay. This was a bit esoteric. Next week, it becomes quite a bit more practical again with using GitHub and earlier. No pressure on you. And using Git and GitHub, that's a bit like using the archive for papers. This is the same thing for software. So if you're doing anything with software, it's important to be able to use tools like Git or GitHub. Even if you use JupyterHub notebooks, it's a good thing to do. I'm sure Dustin will give a proper justification. Okay. No. I'm now beginning to time my lectures to be... This clock seems off. Okay. To stop a bit earlier because the lectures seem to be timed that one lecture ends just when the next starts, and that seems to be a bit inconvenient. So I'm now trying to finish my lectures about 5 minutes early to give you a bit of time. Do you have other questions, comments? Okay. If you get stuck with something like installing Julia or something, feel free to bother Dustin or myself in our office. Thank you.